Rodgers in trouble. It's going to get there. He turned 32 yesterday. Does he have a vintage moment in it? In the end zone, it is caught for the win. Richard Rodgers with a walk-off touchdown. A game ender for the Packers.
Welcome to the Glass Half Empty podcast. I'm Ryan Glasspiegel. We are joined by Seth Davis, a former writer for Sports Illustrated. He announced today that he's joining The Athletic, which is a story we covered about a week and a half ago. Seth, tell me about the courtship process and how you decided that this was where you're going to hitch your wagon.
Well, thanks for having me, Ryan. It actually came together quite quickly. I've been having conversations, you know, over the years and especially within the last year about trying to figure out if I could launch my own national college basketball vertical. I knew I wanted to call it the Field House. I had a total vision of what I wanted and spent a lot of time talking to people, business people, venture capitalists, just sort of about what's involved, and was kind of moving in that direction. I had tabled it when I got busy. So when I got laid off by Sports Illustrated, I had, you know, kind of a roadmap and an idea of what I wanted to do and who I needed to reach out to. One of the people that I reached out to was someone who works with the Chernin Group, and they, unbeknownst to me, had invested in The Athletic. I'd heard about The Athletic. It was actually first mentioned to me last summer by someone who had invested in them, and they were being held up as an example of a business that was worth investing in as opposed to the one that I was looking to get money from. So I kind of knew a little bit about them, but this guy from the Chernin Group put me in touch with Alex Mather, and just so happened, you know, we talked on the phone a couple of times. It just so happened he was coming to Los Angeles where I live with his wife. We got together for coffee. It just so happened I was going to be in San Francisco the following week meeting with somebody, and went over and talked to them. And, you know, by the time I got back to LA, we were engaged in some pretty serious conversations about not whether we were going to be living together, but how it was going to work. And it came, and that's the great thing about dealing with a digital startup is they move very quickly. and he certainly did. And I couldn't be more excited.
So you're going to be launching a site. Do you have any idea of who's going to be on your staff at this point?
Well, I'm surprised you haven't broken this already, Ryan. So maybe I should wait for you to break it before I reveal it. I have a team almost in place. I'm not quite ready to announce it. Hopefully sometime soon, I think I'll be able to answer that question more specifically. But, you know, suffice it to say, there's no shortage of options for someone in my position to be hiring people to cover college basketball, because all the major media companies, not only are they kind of, I wouldn't say giving up on sports journalism, but certainly pulling back on covering it. And I feel like college basketball in particular, there's a lot of blood on the floor there. So I got a lot of a good group of great people coming on at the outset, and there's going to be a lot more to come after that.
You mentioned the Chernin Group. I'm curious about why you thought of them as a potential investor for what you're going to do. And I'm interested to know how you feel about Barstool, which they're now the majority owner of.
Well, Barstool is one of the great success stories. I mean, I think maybe Bleacher Report is the closest thing to it. And so I got referred to Chernin Group by a friend of mine in a town where I live here in Los Angeles. And I went over there and met with them just because I was talking to everybody. So what interested me about Chernin was, first of all, their involvement with AT&T, which is a champion sponsor with the NCAA tournament. And then just the fact that they don't, that not only do they invest, but they incubate and they build digital businesses. I met with Jesse Jacobs over there, as well as Mike Kearns, who is just an absolute stud in the digital world, knows everything about what everyone is doing. So they're just really smart guys and good guys. And you know, I was just kind of in a knowledge collecting process. So I know they've had a lot of success with Barstool, and I'm hoping they'll feel the same way about their involvement with The Athletic.
How many people do you expect to have on your staff on, let's say, November 1st?
Well, you know, it's going to be hard to define staff, to be honest, Ryan. We're going to do a lot with freelance. You know, I think we could have maybe 3 to 5 who are, you know, full-time either staffers or contributors, depending on how you want to define it. You know, what's interesting, Ryan, is going to be the decisions that I'll have to make about, you know, how much content do we want to produce a day? You know, how much is too much? You know, at what point do you get diminishing returns? You know, college basketball is a little bit different animal. You know, they have the Athletic has platforms in Cleveland, Chicago, you know, Toronto, where they're covering local sports. And you can put up, you know, 2 or 3 articles a day, and that's all people really want. They may not have time to read that much. The question in college basketball is, you know, people may only want to come to read 2 or 3 articles a day, but do you have to give them, you know, 15 to 20 articles, let's say, in a given day for them to choose the 2 to 3 that they want to read? So I'm going to want to drill down into teams and conferences so people are feeling that they're getting local coverage as well as the national perspective that someone like myself can bring. But I'm not going to be hiring 100 people either. So we're going to do a lot of work with freelancers. And frankly, I want to dip into college campuses. I meet a lot of young journalism and communication students who are very serious and driven and ambitious about entering the profession. They want to be mentored. They want a chance to get exposure. And I want to provide that for them while they're providing content for me. So I think there's going to be a win-win there as I explore that as an option.
So you mentioned that as soon as, like, even before the SI thing happened, you were thinking about wanting to start a national site. I'm a little bit interested in this because just at the Big Read, I know that we get a lot of NBA and NFL and media people who are interested in national coverage, but we found that college basketball outside of March is a little bit more regionalized. People might be interested in their team that they grew up rooting for or their alma mater or maybe even that conference, but I just don't see a lot of people who are like, I don't know, let's say like Big Ten fans who are interested in Kentucky and vice versa. You believe that there is a big appetite for this such that you can drive maybe like 10 to 15,000 subscriptions through people who are mostly interested in college basketball?
Well, you've asked the key question. And, you know, the great thing, Ryan, about working for a digital company is everything is measurable. So every story that we put up or whatever we do, we'll know if it's working. And if it works, we'll do more of it. And if it's not working, we'll do less of it. So, and I think there has to be a balance there. You know, the numbers, you know, you mentioned 10 to 15,000 subscribers. I mean, I don't want to get too much into numbers, but it's probably not as much as people think to make this a profitable venture. Remember, we're not a publicly traded company. So we're not trying to, you know, fake numbers to match quarterly earnings report to please our investors in Wall Street. That's not how we're built. You know, we can build this slowly, effectively, and substantively. So, you know, I think to answer your question, it's got to be a blend. I think you're exactly right. And, you know, that's why I talked about, you know, drilling down, like, for conferences. You know, can we build a network where we have, you know, beat writers assigned to each conference to produce regular content? I think we can do that. Do we want people like myself doing what I did for Sports Illustrated and driving a national conversation? You know, I think people are going to want that. So, you know, when you're talking about, you know, an entire country to cover and an entire national fan base to cater to, we don't really need that many in the grand scheme. We don't need hundreds of thousands and millions of people, you know, to make it a sustainable business. So I'm going to be trying a little bit of everything, you know, all the way down to the grassroots and all the way up top to a, you know, national 30,000 feet and everything in between. You know, I could envision hiring, you know, beat writers for specific teams for those fan bases who, you know, have that kind of passion and demand for it. So again, that's the great thing, Brian. We never talk about having to think outside the box. You know why? There is no box. This is an internet startup, which is what I've always wanted to be a part of. I'm fascinated by the Silicon Valley culture. Dive in, see what works. We can adapt. We can create. We can adjust. We can figure things out. And we can make decisions and changes on the fly. But frankly, big media companies like Time Inc. Have a hard time doing. So we're going to use that to our advantage.
I don't want to make it sound like my line of questioning is too negative, but
that's so okay. We're journalists. That's what we do. Go ahead.
So one of the people who just signed on as an executive role is Paul Fichtenbaum, who you know from Time Inc. and SI. He presided at SI when he was in charge. SI.com had a redesign, and I know that he wasn't the one sitting there coding this, but I think everyone who worked for SI at the time thought that this redesign was very buggy. Pages would freeze in the middle and things like that. Was that something that when he was in charge of SI, you were upset about at the time?
Well, I'll be honest, and you know, Paul can speak for himself. I think it's something that he was upset about at the time, quite frankly. I mean, I think he's the first to say it did not go so well. But there are a lot of lessons to be learned from that experience, Ryan. And one of the things is that, and this is not to knock anybody. I mean, I had 22 great years at Sports Illustrated. Time Inc. is one of the great, you know, media companies that, you know, the planet will ever see. They're just not built for it. You know, they're not. You know, a place like The Athletic is, you know, their headquarters are in San Francisco. They come right out of the Silicon Valley culture. They're good at this stuff. You know, the old media timings, they're not. I mean, I go back to the days where we had a path, you know, when the internet first started and we had this Pathfinder thing. I don't even know what Pathfinder is, but, you know, it just felt like we were always getting there late. There were a lot of really good, smart people working for the company and working at Sports Illustrated, but they're just not good at it, you know, and that's why these companies are flattering. I always go back to the old, you know, the Wayne Gretzky quote, you know, what people said, someone asked Wayne Gretzky, why were you so good? He said, you know, some people skate to the puck. I skated where the puck is going. I feel like the big, you know, old school media companies have a very hard time figuring out where the puck is going. So by the time it gets there, it's too late. Let me give you another example. I just learned this whole pivot to video thing. We had these meetings in San Francisco with Alex, our CEO, and Stuart Mandel and Paul and their team. And we talked to, you know, Paul said to me that my articles at Sports Illustrated got way more traffic than the videos that I did for SI.com. And I said, well, then why is everyone going to video? He said, well, because the advertisers want video. I said, well, why do advertisers want video if the readers don't want video? The readers want words. It seems very, very basic, but it's just stuck in conflict, and it's sometimes they're just not quick enough to manage their way out of it. So I suffice it to say, I'm very excited for what Paul's going to be a huge asset to me and all of us at The Athletic, and we're going to provide a place for long form quality journalism, and everything else that you've been hearing or what you've been writing, Ryan, and all the sites, is that, you know, that everything's going under. We're here to say that it's not going under. It's alive and well. We just have to have the right business model.
I don't want to go too into this video tangent, but the reason that advertisers want video is then if they have your undivided attention, they think for 10 or 15 seconds, whereas right. With display advertising, a bunch of people have ad blockers. There's a lot of kind of shady traffic metrics that go on to game the system. I would argue that right. That happens with videos as well as with display advertising, but for whatever reason, the advertisers are wise to it happening with display, but not on video yet, as far as I can observe.
Well, I always go back to, I mean, I assume you're a sports fan, you're a consumer of media. I mean, it's pretty annoying when you try to click on a story and the first thing you get is not only a video, but a pre-roll to a video, and then there's ads all over the place. And so, you know, we're very big on, you know, the catchphrase being user experience. Now, listen, I understand the importance of advertising dollars, but, you know, it's like if you're creating a product that is turning off the consumer, I mean, it's obviously not working. You know, I understand when advertisers, and this is definitely, you know, not my real house, but I understand the notion of, well, you know, you click it comes on and they have to see it, but they don't want to see it. And they don't want to do anything when they see it, and they're most likely going to click out of it. And by the way, the company that you're paying this money to is going to, as you said, build all these artificial metrics to make you think like you're getting your money's worth, and you're really not. So eventually, don't you want to be where the consumers want to go? And the consumers want good articles. Yeah, they'll watch videos. And I'm interested in exploring, you know, a video product at the Athletic and at the Fieldhouse that's consistent with what we do, but it's not going to be at the expense of my audience. And my audience, I'm going to have a very intimate relationship. I feel like I know my audience. I've been writing for them and talking to them, talking at them, some might say, for a quarter of a century now. And, you know, the customer is going to come first, and all we're asking is, you know, for, you know, $5 or $6 a month in return, and, you know, the sport is going.
So let's switch gears to straight college basketball talk. Who's your way too early Final Four?
Well, I'll be honest, I'm not really in the weeds on that, Ryan, so I'm probably not a great person to ask at this time of year. I mean, my preseason number one, you know, in the spring, and certainly still is Arizona, especially after their guard Alonzo Trier came back. And then, you know, their freshman, DeAndre Ayton, I've seen him quite a bit in high school. He's phenomenal. He's absolutely phenomenal. He's the Bahamian Kevin Garnett. not as great as Kevin Garnett, maybe, but that type of player. And then, you know, Michigan State has a lot of players back. And Miles Bridges, to me, is going to be a great story for college basketball, because unlike the vast majority of players who came back when they looked at the draft, you know, he really was going to be a first-round pick, probably a lottery pick, and came back, you know, really for all the right reasons. And then you're going to have a lot of the same usual suspects: Duke, Kentucky, Kansas, North Carolina is going to be very good again. And then your mix maker, as we would say in the magazine business, is going to be Wichita State. You know, they came on, they had a great conference year. Everyone talked about how they were underseeded, played well in the tournament, got everybody back. And now they're switching over to the American Athletic Conference. So there's going to be some great, great basketball to be played there.
Would you be in favor of a model in college basketball where it was like the Olympic model, where players were allowed to sign endorsement deals kind of as a carrot to keep some of the stars in the ecosystem for maybe a year or two extra?
Well, yes and no. I definitely feel like they could explore that a little bit more. You know, I understand why schools are reluctant to do it. But look, they just don't want to be in that business, you know. They don't want to have, you know, Nick Saban going into a recruit's living room and say, hey, Alabama, we can get you a $50,000, you know, endorsement deal with the local car dealership. And then having Urban Meyer come in and say, hey, come to Ohio State and we can get you $75,000 at the local furniture store. They just don't want to be in that business. So, is there a reasonable toe we can dip in that water and say, hey, can they make $2,500? Can they make $5,000? Can we cap it at a certain, you know, I'm at least open to that conversation, but you will never be able to compete, nor should they try to compete with the professional leagues in terms of the salary. So we should never look at it as, hey, let's make it more palatable for them to stay. But money, you know, if they want to go get that for money, then college is never going to be able to compete with that. But I'm always in favor of conversations that find better ways to cater to the student athlete without having to, you know, completely blow up the whole amateur model, which I think actually has a lot of virtues, not only for the athletes on, you know, football and basketball, but for all of the athletes on scholarship who are, you know, have access to higher education, which is extremely expensive, you know, on the basis of this amateur model.
I don't know. I just think from even, first of all, from a moral perspective, I think that the schools extract too much money that they pay a lot of these administrators and coaches and like various other aspects where they spend money so that they say that they're not making money. And then from a pragmatic standpoint, I think that they could compete, not like in the tens of millions of dollar range, but with an NBA rookie wage scale, NFL rookie wage scale, keeping some of these stars in the sport, I think would be a tide that lifts all boats, especially in college basketball, where it for, I think, most casual fans, other than the people who are coming back on their own teams, don't really know a lot of the players going into every season right now.
Well, you know, it's interesting, you know, use the word immoral. You know, that's kind of an interesting word. I mean, certainly the divide, the dichotomy between, you know, school officials saying we don't have the money to pay these guys, but Clemson can spend, you know, $3 trillion on a football facility so they can play frisbee golf or whatever's going on down there. You know, the money that administrators make, the money that, you know, bowl, you know, games make. That's bad optics. There's no question about that. You know, when you start getting into, you know, moral argument, that's kind of a hard argument to make. I mean, generally speaking, I mean, I could make an argument that, you know, it's immoral to try to keep these kids in school when what's best for them is to go pro. You know, I think you can make a case that the NBA draft minimum is immoral because, you know, here's a poor kid who with the stroke of a pen has a chance to alter the history of his family. But he's not allowed to do that because the NBA wants to limit his bites at the apple because each time he gets a new contract, he makes huge dollars. So, you know, to me, I'm a big freedom of movement guy. We could have a whole conversation about transfers in that regard. But, I mean, basically, Ryan, you would have a hard time, and you're in this business, and maybe you can rebut this. You'd have a hard time coming up with a metric to tell me that college basketball, even college football, that it's struggling on any level because kids are turning pro. We're talking about, you know, maybe, you know, 1 to 2 dozen players a year in a sea of prospects. Yeah, what I as a fan, as someone who covers it, rather see Carl Anthony Towns play 4 years of college basketball. Yeah, it'd be great for me, great for the sport. But the fact that they're leaving, whether it's TV ratings or rights fees, I mean, you know, compared to all the other sports, I think you'd have a hard time, you know, making an argument that college basketball is really suffering, you know, big time because of what's happening, aside from the feelings of fans who would like, in a selfish way, like to have these players staying at college when what's really best for the players and their families is for them to have the chance to go pro.
Well, I mean, the way I'd rebut that is, yeah, the NCAA tournament rights fees are ginormous. They're locked up through approximately 2085, and those aren't going away anytime soon. But look at, like, what happened with ESPN and SI letting go of a bunch of people who cover the sport nationally. The interest just isn't there outside of March from a generalist perspective. And if they could have kept, like, Carl Anthony Towns and people of that nature in there for 3-4 years, now those days are gone forever, but if Kentucky boosters wanted to get together and pay that man his money that he would be making in the NBA, I think that that would be better for the sport. But I don't think that we're ever going to come to a point, at least not in 5 or 10 minutes, where I'm like, you're right. And you're like, you're right.
No, I mean, look, we both want what's best for the sport. I think it's a little bit of a stretch to connect those two dots, to be honest. You know, between, you know, layoffs and kids turning pro in college basketball, you know this far better than I do, Ryan, but the forces that have led to all of these decisions, you know, are a lot greater than, you know, you know, a dozen or two college basketball players deciding to go to the NBA as opposed to coming back to school for a second year or a third year. You know, I mean, the business is facing challenges on a lot of fronts. So, you know, I mean, I think, you know, the TV ratings are what they are. The rights fees are obviously through the roof. You know, these programs are seem to be doing pretty well health wise. So there's just really nothing the only thing that can compel the schools to do business differently is in the legal system, and they keep winning. You know, I don't know if you've noticed, but they're on a pretty good winning streak as far as keeping that amateur, even when they lose, like in the Albanian case, the actual application of those judgments. Feels like a win. So I don't see this amateur model changing anytime soon.
If you have to go see a college basketball game in one arena that before you die and one opponent, what is that?
That I haven't been to. I've been to all of them, obviously.
No, if you're telling someone who's a big sports fan, like, you have to make sure you see Kentucky play X, you have to see Kansas play X, what building, what game do you need to see?
Well, you know, I have to say, as a college basketball fan, but also a Duke graduate, you know, seeing a Duke North Carolina game in Cameron Indoor Stadium to me is as good as a sporting event gets. I would say, as a venue, my favorite really is Allen Fieldhouse. The feel, the vibe, the size, everything about that building just makes you happy to be alive. There's no, I guess, you know, Missouri was kind of their rival for a while. They don't play anymore. But, you know, a Duke Carolina game in Cameron Indoor Stadium, and if I know I'm going to meet my maker the next day and I can't be with my family that night, that would be a pretty good way to send it off.
Is there anything we didn't discuss with The Athletic or general college basketball that you want to talk about right now?
No, just stay tuned. Everybody sign up. TheAthletic.com/FieldHouse and come be a part of it and support us, and hopefully you'll feel like you're getting your money's worth.
All right, thanks, Seth. Good luck with everything.
All right, Ryan, great talking to you, man. Thanks for having me on. Thanks for everything.
All right, bye.
Okay.
Strange.